for the most part, I'd say that most of us live a life, according to a script that we've been given that we think is our own. And the truth of the matter is that, you know, underneath that script is a real life, an enjoyable one, one that you can be a lot more successful with and be a lot happier with. But most of us aren't aware that we're hypnotized.
Hi everyone, Drew Brode here, host of the Broken Brain Podcast. On today's episode, we're talking all things happiness, joy, and fulfillment with author, TV host, and celebrity happiness coach, Robert Mack. It's a fascinating conversation. Turns out human beings are very bad at actually knowing what makes them happy and what doesn't. We're gonna be talking about that and more in today's conversation. Stay tuned. Welcome to the Broken Brain Podcast, where we dive deep into the topics of neuroplasticity, epigenetics, mindfulness, functional medicine, and mindset, all with the goal of helping you understand how your brain is not broken. I repeat, your brain is not broken. I'm your host, Drew Brode, and each week my team and I bring on a new guest who we think can help you improve your brain health, feel better, and live more. This week's guest is Robert Mack. Robert Mack is an Ivy League educated celebrity happiness coach, positive psychology expert, and author of Happiness from the Inside Out. He's also a TV host and personality for OWN and E. Robert hosts and produces the Ever Talk Live, a daily live streaming morning show shot here in LA, focusing on happiness in Hollywood. His work has been endorsed by Oprah and many others of celebrity and note. Robert Mack, welcome to the Broken Brain Podcast.
Thanks so much for having me, man. I appreciate that. Who's that guy you're talking about there? That's awesome.
Shout out to our mutual friend Cal.
Yes. Oh my
gosh. Who introduced us.
Went to business school with Cal Amir. I love that guy.
What a great guy. Yeah. And we'll come back to Cal.
Yeah.
I wanted to kick off the interview with a little thing that you wrote on Instagram that I'm going to pass over to you to read.
Uh-oh. All right.
Would you mind reading this for our podcast guest?
Oh, yes. So your happiness is your gift to the world. The happier you are, the more loving you are. The happier you are, the more lovable, meaning easier to love you are. The happier you are, the more kind, caring, generous, and charitable you are. The happier you are, the healthier you are, literally and figuratively. When you're happy, you have only happiness, in other words, hate to share. And when you're happy, you only have happiness, which is love to share. That's not speculation, that's science. Being happy is not selfish or irresponsible. Being happy is one of the most selfless, most responsible things you can do for the people you love, the people who love you, and for the world at large. Be happy. It's the least you can do for yourself and the world.
You know, when I read that post, I just thought that summarized why happiness is so important in this day and age, because we can look at politics, we can look at the news, we can look at the state of the world, even though the world is so much better than it was, arguably, yeah, many years ago, even though there's a lot of injustice still left over, and it can make us feel like, how much control do we have? And yet, investing in our happiness, which is what you're all about and what this podcast is focused on, is one of the best things we could do for the world.
Oh, no question about it. I mean, if there's a master key to life and to success, in any area of your life, it's happiness. It's happiness.
And it sounds so cliche, and yet I don't think we talk about it enough. And one of the ways that I know that is that we're still not talking about happiness in the school system.
Oh my goodness, absolutely. And you and I both have had experiences as a result of that that were quite negative for a long period of time, or at least felt very uncomfortable. You know, of course, it's led us both to being here. But no question about it. I mean, we've got the unhappy, you know, in all of humankind, we've never been in a place where people are more unhappy. So in 71 years in the United States, we've got the unhappiest population right now that we've ever had.
And when you look at that, do you look at a culmination of, is that from like happiness surveys? Is that a combination of like anxieties and other things that are out there?
Yeah.
Any thoughts on how they're measuring that?
Yeah, so great question. I think the Gallup organization does a lot of the measurements, as does the University of Pennsylvania. You know, there's an entire program really at the University of Pennsylvania, the one I graduated from, that really focuses on the science of applied positive psychology. So it's really the study and science of what makes life worth living. It's an Ivy League degree. You know, it's all face, valid and time-tested. So they've been doing thousands of studies like that for decades now.
Amazing. Yeah. And we're going to get to that, but I want to go into your hero's journey.
Yeah.
Because you're here with us sitting in this chair in our studio in Santa Monica, but at one point in time, that wasn't a guarantee. So I'd like you to just share a little bit of your story so that our listeners can have context about why you are now the go-to happiness coach, but it wasn't always that way.
Yeah, boy, great question, brother. I mean, I didn't feel like a hero. So I love that you call it a hero's journey. I felt mostly like a zero. And, you know, I was born into a beautiful family. Everybody was, you know, my entire family was healthy. They were loving. We didn't have a whole lot of money. But boy, did my parents love me, you know, and I didn't consider myself that athletic or, you know, all that great academically, but I did well on the sports field. I did well in the classroom, mostly because my dad was a disciplinarian and I wanted to make sure I didn't disappoint him. So I worked extraordinarily hard. And despite sort of having this incredible life in objective ways, as I got older and as I matured, this sort of deep pessimism and self-hate and self-loathing attitude and experience that I had had just continued to grow and deepen. And I got to a point eventually when I was probably about, I remember about 13, when I was so miserable with my life that I started having suicidal thoughts. And then as I got older, they just became more and more frequent.
And at that time, if I can interrupt your story for 1 second, did your parents have any idea?
Not really. I was a real shy kid. In fact, I was voted most shy in my high school class, which is like the worst thing that could happen to a shy kid, is to be the center, you know, of attention.
Was that sort of like, what do they call them, senior superlative?
Yes, it was my senior superlative. I mean, it was just embarrassing, you know. And I remember actually being at the senior banquet and they played that song, Shy Guy. I don't know if everybody remembers that song, but...
He's a shy guy.
Yeah.
It's like a reggae song,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. I mean, just incredible. So, you know, I was just a real shy kid. I didn't really talk hardly at all. I just observed. I mean, we mentioned... the ways in which we're similar that way. And, you know, so nobody really knew. They just thought, well, that's Rob being Rob. He's quiet, doesn't say a whole lot. And, you know, my dad used to say, oh, you know, I was afraid of my own shadow. I was just full of anxiety and fear. You know, as it grew, and it was a lot of things. You know, people say, well, what was wrong? It seems like your life was just fine for the most part. But I had this existential angst that I just couldn't understand or process or manage. It was basically like I looked at life and I thought, my goodness, all these people I'm working so hard to love and to get to love me, all these things that I'm working so hard to achieve or accomplish or acquire, like none of it's filling me up inside. Like none of it's making me happy. And in fact, I'm disappointed over and over and over again. And all these people who I love and all these things I accomplish, one day it's all going to be ripped out of my hands by death.
You know, in the Indian tradition, they talk about like old soul. And that sometimes when you have a young child who is an old soul, they're looking out there in the world and they're not feeling a sense of completion for the information that they're getting. It's not that their parents are bad. It's not that they're not enjoying some aspects of school, but there's this deeper yearning for like something bigger. And because they can only see what's in front of them, it's kind of like, is this it? Or you get caught up in the day to day. There's a deeper craving that's not being met.
Bro, all of that. That was all of it. Exactly. You just nailed it. Sounds like first-hand experience there. But that was I was like looking into life and I was just taking in everything that, you know, I was like a sponge. I was taking in everything that was shared with me. And like you said, I had the most incredible parents and family and teachers, but it just never felt like enough. In fact, more than that, it felt so empty. Every experience felt empty. You know, so eventually I got to a place, I had a great consulting job. You know, after I went to school, incredible girlfriend, I was making good money. And I just got to a place where I was like, you know, I'm going to do something about this, you know, and begin sort of researching ways to kill myself.
Yeah, which is heavy. And I just want to share, you know, we'll probably add this at the beginning of the podcast too, but we are going to be talking about suicide and suicidal thoughts. And for anybody that's in that place, know that you're not alone. There's incredible hotlines that are out there. One is from the National Suicide Hotline that's there. It's 800-273-8255. It's all confidential. It's free. These topics are important, so we're going to talk about them straight on. But if anybody is having suicidal thoughts, know that you can always call that number, 800-273-8255. So let's pick up the story from there, because when I was reading your book and I was following along with the story, the first time that I think I remember you saying that you were having these thoughts was in university, right?
Yeah.
And like at a very strong level. And in fact, you talk about kind of how you were really into philosophy and how you were really into sort of like wanting to be the embodiment of like the lone philosopher who was sort of dark and contemplating things in their life and was like... separating himself from other people, and you were sort of living that aspect and going deeper into it. and pick up the story from where you left
off.
That's
a great point, man. Like, I thought that was sexy.
You thought it was sexy.
You know, it was kind of cool. You know, it was part of me that felt that. Because, you know, ultimately, at the end of the day, you know, I loved women, right? And I was like, oh, well, there's part of this that's kind of interesting and kind of sexy, that moody, sort of dark, you know, character that's just kind of brooding all the time. You know, and I also had this idea that, oh, well, the most creative people are that way. And
all the archetypes that we read about in stories
exactly.
And see on TV.
Yeah, you find later the ways in which that's bunk. You know, science disproves that for the most part, that we're at our creative best when we're actually feeling quite joyful. Or inspired, uplifted.
Hey everyone, it's Patrick from the Broken Brain team. Sorry to interrupt. You're about to hear an audio issue we had for this episode, but it resolves in about 45 seconds and shouldn't interfere with your listening. Thanks for tuning in, and let's get back to the episode.
You know, I sort of had that going on, and I was like,
you know, Stoic philosophers, and I was reading, you know, basically so much philosophy. I was reading everything I could get my hands on. But, you know, when you've got this filter on the world where you see everything through a very pessimistic, very depressed, sort of dysphoric lens, that's your experience no matter who and what you read. I can read those same authors and poets and philosophers now, and I'm uplifted by it, I'm inspired by it, I'm excited by it. But at the time, I just saw and began to receive things that confirmed and validated this very unhappy perspective I had in the world.
The world is bleak and there's no meaning to it, so what's kind of the point?
Exactly. If you're going to die anyway, what's the point of like struggling through it, like striving and never arriving? So that just drove me bonkers. So I went online and started researching ways
to kill myself. I realized I didn't have access to lots of ways. I also realized that I didn't want it to be like super violent. Like I didn't want like people to have to clean up blood everywhere. You know, and I didn't have access to like, you know, guns and things. So I decided I was going to slit my wrist. That was the thing I decided. You know, and so one day went to the kitchen. I got a kitchen knife. And as much as I wanted to kill myself, I still didn't want to experience too much pain. I dug the knife in. I still have the suicide test marks on my wrist there. And, you know, something very strange and unexpected happened, which is that I felt perfect peace.
Yeah, you talk about in the book, and I'll pull a quote from there. You say, in that moment, you thought, wow, how interesting is it that a simple thought or the notion or idea, the one that you wanted to commit suicide, changed your mood so quickly. If only I could master that power. So if I'm understanding, when you had come to that conclusion and you had said, okay, this is my way out from the suffering, and you were battling all sorts of internal demons, you know, growing up in the Christian community, it's like, you said you had a fear of going to hell.
Totally.
And, but then in like the Buddhist tradition, which you were reading about philosophy, you're like, well, if I also commit suicide, maybe I'll just be reborn into the same thing and I'll be just dealing with this in another lifetime.
Yeah.
And in the gravity of all that, you felt peace and you thought, where is that peace coming from? Maybe there's another way out.
Oh my goodness, beautifully said. Boy, you do your research. My goodness, brother. I mean, that was exactly it. I started, you know, the one benefit I've had the entire time is that I'm a genuinely curious person. And so I did. I explored all of these different sort of spiritual traditions, all the religious traditions, and I tended to find that for the most part, as much as I wanted this to be an answer, it wasn't really an answer. Like, you know, the Buddhist philosophy didn't say so, and, you know, Christian philosophy didn't say so, and Taoism didn't say so, and, you know, even, you know, so I sort of had that in the back of my mind as well. But this experience of, like, you know, sort of having this peace and really bliss wash over me for no good reason, as I began to dig the knife into my wrist, it had this sort of interruptive kind of effect on my life. And I said, well, I can postpone suicide for like an hour. You know, at the beginning, that's all it was. Like, I'll just put it off for an hour. Maybe I should just do a little more research. Like you said, I had that epiphany, but I hadn't quite processed all of it yet. You know, and even when I had written the book, I still was processing it. You know, and now as I look back, I realize that, yes, part of it was a thought that led to this peace. But I would say that at a deeper level, it was no thinking. It was not thinking. It was non-thinking that allowed me to experience this, like, lasting and abiding in a meaningful peace, even though in that moment it felt temporary. But I've come to discover it's always underneath whatever it is we're thinking.
Yeah, in that moment, you, as Eckhart Tolle would say, you transcended thought.
Exactly. Boom. That was it. That was it. Now, that's taken me a decade almost to come around to really sort of not only living, but it took me a while to just even understand that. Or even, you know, I'd read, you know, Power of Now, you know, years and years and years and years ago. But until I really started to apply it to my own experience, I really didn't have as deep a grasp on it as I wanted to.
Yeah, I think in Buddhism they call it like a satari, a moment of awakening.
Yes.
And that was your own version of that.
Totally.
So what happened from there? You said, okay, I'm going to postpone this a little bit. Let me do some research. What was literally like the next thing that you did from coming from that moment where you were about to, you actually did cut your wrist, but you didn't go through with the full act. What happened from there?
Yeah. So at that point, I put the suicide thing in my back pocket and I said, well, no matter how bad things get, that's always an option for me. So it's not like I took it off the table. You know, at no point in time this early had I taken it off the table. I just postponed it. That hour slipped into several hours, which slipped into several days, and that slipped into several weeks and months. The entire time, I was still experiencing suicidal ideation. It wasn't like, but I was doing research, and I was trying to actually do and apply things that I was reading. So I would look into the field of psychology and spirituality and philosophy and religion. Anywhere and everything was sort of fodder, you know, for and grist for the mill, so to speak. So as I began like reading stuff, I would begin applying it, and then I would kind of track if it was working or not. And I discovered things that were actually working. You know, I was not having a suicidal thought every couple minutes. I was having it every, you know, 10 minutes instead, or 20 minutes, and or more. So over time, I just inch by inch, just sort of like dug myself out of this deep, dark, depressing hole. And then at some point, I got to a place where it's like, oh, I had a whole day and I didn't really think about suicide at all. You know, but it would be 3 steps forward, 10 steps back, 20 steps, you know, and it was back and forth kind of experience. And then eventually got to a place where I felt like I just started making decisions on top of the research, right? And I think that's when things began to really shift. I did something even like, I came to a realization where it was like, well, if everything I'm doing is leading me to be this unhappy, I should try doing the opposite of everything I've been doing. It was like a Seinfeld episode, right? I mean, quite literally. And I just started doing things. I said, well, I don't really love living in this cold weather. I know I love warm weather. See if I can move. I don't particularly love this consulting job. I love the people there, but let's see if I can find some kind of new professional path. And I just started actually taking action around it.
So a lot to unpack there. And I want to first say that for our listeners, even if you've never had suicidal thoughts, and sometimes it's hard for people who haven't had suicidal thoughts, I haven't. Right. And I can say, even if it's tough for me, to try to put yourself in the other person's position and imagine that. But everybody has hit a point in their life where they felt that things were really bleak. So what I've heard from one of our past podcast guests, my business partner's wife, Mia Lux, who came on here and talked about her journey, is she said, take the bleakest moments in your life if you've never had suicidal thoughts and then magnify that by 100,000. That's how you can, if you can imagine that, then you know the severity of what somebody's gone through, that they can't see anything but that. It's not even operating from a place of necessarily intellect, like weighing the pros and cons necessarily. It's just this feeling that you're encompassed with in your entire life. You can't think about anything else. So that's the first thing for our listeners. The second thing from there is when you were trying these things and you were questioning your life, how much of it was asking yourself, were you following somebody else's path for your life, or were you following your path for life?
Beautifully said. Absolutely. And in the beginning, to be quite frank with you, that was part of the realization. That was one of the first realizations, was like, wait, all of this life I'm living, for the most part, is somebody else's idea of happiness and success. This isn't an authentic life that I'm living. Not that I'm not authentic with people, but it was hard for me to find joy and happiness in doing things that felt so against my own nature. Like, I felt like I wasn't designed and built to be in the corporate world in that way. I didn't feel like I was designed and built to be in this particular relationship with a really beautiful, incredible woman, but it just wasn't a good fit. And I was doing all these things because I thought that's what you should do. And I realized later, you know, kind of shooting all over yourself. But that was precisely, the realization I had.
When you were thinking about those things, you know, I've quoted this book a few times by the author Bronnie Ware. She spent a lot of time with, you know, elderly people, people often that were in hospice care at the end of their life, who were just days, weeks, or sometimes in months away from passing away. And they started sharing their regrets with her. It's called The 5 Regrets of the Dying. And the top regret that's in there is, I wish I had the courage to live the life that I wanted to live, and not the life that others wanted me to live. So for you, you were talking about your corporate job. Where do you think, I mean, it's not like one person told you, like, you have to do this, and maybe they did tell you. I don't know how influential your parents were in that decision or not, but where do you think those pressures were that were pushing you to want to live that life that wasn't the right life for you?
Everywhere. I think we're inundated with it all the time, everywhere. Every TV show you watch, every movie you watch, so many books you read, although less so with the books, I think, for the most part. You know, every story you're told, you know, the classes that you go to, the teachers that you talk to. I mean, for the most part, I'd say that most of us live a life, you know, according to a script that we've been given that we think is our own. And the truth of the matter is that, you know, underneath that script is a real life, an enjoyable one, one that you can be a lot more successful with and be a lot happier with. But most of us aren't aware that we're hypnotized. I mean, that's part of the challenge of being hypnotized, is that you're not aware that you're hypnotized. Otherwise, you might snap out of the hypnosis. And so, you know, you're kind of not there to know that you're not there. And so that was my experience, is that I wasn't quite aware of the countless ways in which I was being fed a script, or given a script that I was living out, and the ways in which that was making me happy or unhappy. You know, so I took a lot of the responsibility myself and said, well, there's something just wrong with me, you know, and not that I wasn't having, you know, unproductive and unhappy and unhealthy thoughts sort of, you know, and behaviors. But it was a script that I was living that I thought I had no other option but to live.
Mm, powerful. So ultimately that led you to a place where you started studying this for real.
Yeah, dude, I was going in. I was like, if I'm going to live, I'm going to really live. I'm going to be alive. I'm going to be joyful. I'm going to be blissful. Like, there's no half step in here. Like, there's no half-hearted effort here. I'm either going to live and be blissfully happy, or I'm going to die. That was literally life or death for me. And I think that would sort of made the difference for me, because I was all in.
Yeah. So in that period of time, I'm sure you also started asking yourself, what is happiness?
Yes.
And you were into philosophy before. I'm sure you asked yourself before. But after this moment of awakening, this satori, this period of time where you said, oh my gosh, just the idea that I don't have to go through this anymore gave me peace. Well, is there other ways to access that peace that's there? What did you come to the conclusion on for yourself at that time of what happiness actually meant?
Oh, I love this. So there's been levels to that, right? So I discovered in the beginning, it was like, no, happiness is what you do. It's all about what you do, right? And then I realized later, oh no, you know, that's part of it. Sometimes you start there. You say, I'm going to do different things. I'm going to do different things for work, or I'm going to date different people, or I'm going to hang out with different people, or I'm going to do different activities. But then I discovered that happiness isn't what you do, although it's encouraging in terms of happiness. And then later it became, oh, well, no, happiness is what you think. It's all about what you think. You know, and that was part of it. That led part of the way. And then I realized happiness isn't even what you think. To a large extent, just happiness is what you are. It's not what you do. It's not what you think. It's what you are. And most of that happiness, all of that happiness, is overlooked. And the overlooking of happiness is the search for happiness, which, you know, Peter Crohn spoke to very well, which is really itself unhappiness. Mm. But that's the discovery that I had over time, was that in the very beginning, I thought it was what you do. And then that led me to think, well, no, it's just what you think. Because sometimes I'd have the same experience, or I'd be doing the same thing, but in one moment I was happy, the next moment I was unhappy. So it's like, no, it's not about what you do. It's not about a state of mind, although that's in happiness from the inside out. That's kind of where we are and what I described there. It's not a state of mood. That's the next level, is that you think it's a state of mood. It's really a state of being. And that state of being is something that is infinitely and eternally available to you at all times, points, and places, and with all people, right? It's what you are. And when you're not thinking, you experience it perfectly. That's why we all love, like, the dreamless state of sleep. In dreamless sleep, we're perfectly content. We're not thinking about ourselves. We're not thinking about the world. We're not thinking about any of our desires or fears. We're just in that place of perfect peace and happiness.
Because the societal understanding of happiness is that this thing will make me happy.
That's how you sell
if stuff. I get this thing. In fact, for the listeners right now, it's like, think about something in your life right now that even on a subtle level, you might still want to have happen. You're hoping that it happens. You're trying to accomplish it. You're making progress towards it. But it's when we have that attachment that, oh, once I get this thing, once this thing happens, then I'll be happy. Then I'll be complete. And you're saying, let's break that cycle. And how can we embody it right now?
Oh, beautifully said, man. So eloquent. Like, yeah, that is the promise that the world makes, and that even the people that love you most make, but cannot possibly keep. You know, the world makes a promise it cannot keep. That promise is happiness. Okay? It can keep, it makes and keeps the promise of pleasure, of entertainment, of distraction, of lust, and a lot of things that we associate with happiness, that isn't that perfect, peaceful aliveness that we're ultimately after. But only one thing can provide you happiness, and that's you yourself. And it's not something that you need to think yourself to. It's something that you can only think yourself out of. Right? You can't think yourself to happiness. You can only think yourself out of happiness because you are happiness. You don't do happiness. You are happiness. So that realization and recognition alone is something that, you know, for marketing products or for trying to sell services, you know, you're not going to sell a whole lot of services and products if your marketing plan is that this thing won't make you happy, right? So
right. It's like, it's almost like marketers have to create lack.
Yeah, totally.
And they have to convince you that you're not enough. And that's the way that then you have a void and you want to get the product. I mean, there's a lot of reasons to get products, but that sort of aspirational idea really comes from something that was created, and I'm sure it's been around forever, but has really been taken to the top here in America.
Yes, beautifully said. I love that. And you're right. And ultimately, at the end of the day, true happiness isn't aspirational. It's more like, you know, and it's not about acquisitiveness. It's really more about inquisitiveness, like, you know, inquiring deep into who you are. It's not something that's aspirational. It's something that's inspirational, meaning that it's something within you that you experience sort of most consistently when you're just sort of resting in the spirit of who you are, in spirit itself.
So as you continued your studies,
yeah,
and it wasn't now just a personal research, you actually started incorporating into your official studies that were there. What did you see inside of the science?
Yeah.
Because so far we've been talking about it from a philosophical level and a level, we've been using words to talk about going beyond thought,
yes,
in the best way that we can, but you actually saw that there was a lot of science out there. There was a lot of research out there. So what were some of the first things that you came across in that department?
So I'm going to distill all this down. You know, the first thing I think that was very exciting for me was that it just confirmed what I had experienced, which was that we're experiencing this progress paradox, you know, for, you know, at least 50 years at that point in time, which was that as life has gotten better, most people were feeling worse for it. Okay, so that was a common theme and experience for lots of people, particularly in developed countries. Okay, so we had more anxiety, we had more depression, we had more Axis 1 and Axis 2 disorders. You know, we had more people that were suicidal, we had more people that experienced sort of stress-related, you know, symptomology in some way or disease and illness. And so that was the one thing that just sort of overwhelmed me, was that I'm not alone.
Right, because we think that as long as we're progressing in life and we can accomplish more, then the nations that have the highest GDP or the average income per capita or low poverty rates. Now, there is some stuff to that. Sure. You know, when you're extremely poor, and we'll talk about that, that can put you in such a state where you really can't embrace happiness to some degree. And I'm sure there's a lot there. We'll come back to that. But why aren't the richest nations the happiest people?
Exactly.
And you're saying that it wasn't just you. Maybe it's a byproduct of the society that we live in.
Totally. It's just a false premise. This idea that success leads to happiness. That was the primary sort of takeaway that I experienced sort of first, was that success doesn't lead to happiness, that, you know, the folks that are sort of happiest, they don't necessarily make the most money, they're not the healthiest. You know, none of these things were correlated with happiness. So for instance, most of us think, well, at the very least, okay, like having good health, like being in good health, has got to be correlated with happiness. Not the case. Objective health is not correlated with happiness. Subjective health is, meaning your experience, your perception of your health is correlated with happiness, right? Or something else like age. Most of us think of like older people as becoming like increasingly unhappy, like the grumpy old guy or the grumpy old woman. But the fact is, that's not true. As we get older, we tend to get happier because we experience fewer highs and fewer lows. And so we experience this more stable sort of psychological and emotional, you know, life.
Probably also because, you know, I love a lot hanging out with old people because they're just like, not a lot really matters.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. There's perspective.
I'm not going to give an F about this
right, exactly,
little tiny thing. Don't sweat
exactly
the small stuff.
Exactly. I've got no Fs to give. 100%. You know, other stuff like, well, clearly marriage. You know, we often think, well, marriage certainly can. Shouldn't it boost our happiness? Well, no. I mean, when you first get married, you get a little bump, but then you quickly return to your baseline level of happiness. And sometimes you dip way below that. We see the divorce, you know, statistics these days, and that's all the evidence you need. Well, what about kids? Well, surprisingly enough, and anybody who has kids knows this, but the first kid, you know, really, you take a hit to your happiness levels with that first kid. With the second kid, it's statistically significant the hit that you sort of take to your happiness rating or level, and your happiness ratings don't return to their original baseline level until your kids leave the house, right? So like, you know, so love kids. Nobody wants to trade their kids in. Maybe a few people do. But for the most part, you know, kids don't make you happier.
And there's a book on this. Actually, two writers from the New York Times, or at least one of them is from the New York Times, they asked this question, I think, after having kids. I haven't read the book, but I saw their TED Talk and the summary. And it's called All Joy and No Fun.
Oh, I love that.
I don't remember the subtitle, but it's basically like the truth about kids.
Yeah.
There's a lot of joy, but sometimes the fun comes out. And also, that's a byproduct of the modern society that we live in, because this experiment is happening in America and other Western countries and developed countries that are out there, which is, for the first time in humanity, parents, a mom and a dad, or any couple that's out there who's raising a kid, is doing it alone for the first time. There's no grandparents around. We're not living in households with four generations inside of it. We don't have this village that is literally feeding our kids, taking them to school, helping us out, teaching them. It's all on us, and parents are getting overloaded, and it's sucking the fun and the happiness out of parenting.
Wow, brilliant. Yeah, more connected, less supported. That's how people, you know, and the connection is really just, you know, technically or technologically, right? I mean, folks don't, so you're absolutely right about that. You know, folks, that's why folks feel so alone these days, right? The loneliness ratings are higher than ever, you know, despite being connected.
So true. So I cut you off, and you were going through basically a few different things. We were talking about marriage doesn't necessarily lead to happiness. Kids doesn't necessarily lead to happiness. Success and financials, you know, it's not that somebody goes from making $100,000 a year to like $170,000 a year and see sustained happiness from that. And what did that leave you with?
Yeah. And I want to just highlight that last point you said, because I think it's critical, which is that, like, you know, if you're living at a level below a level of subsistence, meaning you can't pay your basic utilities and bills for most places in the United States, maybe not LA, but it's like $75,000.
Right.
Right. And then once you hit about 100, 125, especially, you experience the diminishing marginal utility of the dollar, meaning you get less happiness for every dollar that you
make. But if you're making like $30,000 a year and you start making 75, there is research that shows that that can significantly improve your lifestyle, the ability to pay bills, make things happen. And that does, those cofactors contribute to our overall success.
Exactly. Beautifully said. So that was the major takeaway. You know, success doesn't lead to happiness. And then, so that wasn't enough. I was like, okay, that leaves me kind of confirmed and validated in what I've been experiencing. But then I also discovered, well, while success doesn't lead to happiness, happiness does lead to success. Like, if you want to improve your life, one of the best things you can possibly do is just learn to get happy. Like, if you get happy, you improve your health, right? So, and you improve your longevity. So you live 6 to 7 years longer, right? Happiness also, if you care about love, you want to care about happiness, because happier people get married earlier, stay married longer, and are happier in all the relationships, whether they're married or not. You know, if you care about money, you definitely want to care about happiness, because happiness, of course, is the point and purpose of the money that you make. But more than that, the happier you get, the more you improve your chances of making great money. Right now, there's a, you know, sort of end point to that, because it's more like a bell curve, because if you get so happy, you don't care about money at all. Right. But the point is that as you increase your happiness, so happier people, for instance, they make about $600,000 to $700,000 more on average over the course of their entire life. Right. So it improves that. So really, in all ways, you know, if you're wanting to improve your life, the objective circumstances and conditions of your life, happiness is a great start.
Mm. So we talked about a whole series of things that don't lead to happiness. Yeah. And then we went into how actually happiness, when you do have it, can give us a lot of those things and make our marriage better and make these aspects better. You know, John Gottman, the researcher at the Gottman Institute, who I've talked about a couple of times on the podcast, my girlfriend and I are actually in a premarital program through the a Gottman trained marital therapist here. Shout out to Michael. We'll link him up in the show notes if anybody's in LA and looking for a great family and marriage therapist. And they put such an emphasis on couples that invest in their happiness together through these scientifically proven things that they've done their own trials on, genuinely see improved marriages, more longevity, happier sense of intimacy within the couple, and less rates of divorce that are out there. So we know that when we do step into that, it can improve those areas of life. So now let's go to the other side. If those things don't lead to happiness. Success doesn't lead to happiness. Automatically getting married doesn't lead to happiness. These other factors, what actually does contribute to our happiness?
Two things. First of all, love the Gottmans. Amazing, right? I mean, anybody can predict whether a relationship's going to last. You can predict it in 30 seconds. You know, I love. Back to what does lead to happiness. You know, so they've got, there's a formula essentially, and the formula basically is that, I think you've talked about this in previous episodes, but 50% of your happiness is really genetically determined, right? It's 50%. Then you've got 40% really that are voluntary.
So when you say genetically determined, you mean like also based on like your societal conditions?
Mostly it's so great question. So it's really a preset is what it is. So it sort of, it provides you the clay. And you might be leaning in one direction or the other in terms of happiness itself. But the beautiful thing about even the DNA or genetic piece of it is that it's all malleable, right? So we talk about epigenetics or things like that, but think different thoughts and you put yourself in different environments and you eat different food. All of a sudden, all these things, contribute or not to the happiness that your experience are sort of preset for, right? So even that 50% that's sort of genetically encoded, even that is perfectly malleable. It's not like height, where it's set and you can't do much about it at all or nothing about it.
Yeah, like for example, at our medical clinic at the Ultra Wellness Center and other functional medicine doctors, they'll often do genetic tests on people to find out if they have a mutation for this gene, which is called MTHFR. And if you have that mutation, which I believe like 14% of the population does, that's just one example, you cannot convert, you can't methylate nutrients as well as somebody who doesn't have that mutation. And when you can't do that, you're missing a whole bunch of things inside of your diet, even if you're eating them, because you don't have the ability to process it and use those things like B vitamins. My business partner has that mutation, and he says that's one of the things that when he was in China and exposed to environmental toxins or other aspects, that he was severely nutrient deficient in certain things, even though he was eating a good diet, and that can clinically make you more predisposed to being depressed.
Oh my goodness. See, this is why I geek out with conversations with you, man. Like, I mean, I just love that. Like everything you shared there, it's just beautiful. And you do set up a great point, which is that, sometimes if you're, born in a certain way, it sets you off on a path that you can do something about. But if you don't, then you might find yourself just, experiencing increasing either happiness or unhappiness. And a lot of it won't feel like it's in your control. I forget who it was. Maybe it was Carl Jung who said, until you sort of make the unconscious conscious, you live your life and you call it fate. But the idea is that we do have a choice and we do have a decision. And that's like 40% of it, right? More than that, because the genes also can be affected by what you do on a voluntary sort of basis. And some of those voluntary things are like, the relationships that you're in. Like relationships are one of the highest like contributors to your happiness. Learning optimism. Like there's an actual scientific way to describe optimism, and it really is about explanatory style. So how do you describe or explain things to yourself when bad things happen and good things happen? You can learn how to do that better.
Going back to your friend, my friend, Peter Crohn.
Yes.
And it's the questioning of the meaning that we add to situations.
100%.
Like what label are we putting on that event? Are we saying that because that presentation at work didn't go well, that I'm a failure and I'm worthless and I really don't deserve to be promoted? Or that we're on our path to figuring things out, I'm getting better each day.
Yes.
It's like, how do we look at that component? Take us back for a second to your life.
Yeah.
And what was an example of something that you felt that you had shifted the meaning on when you had made this transition?
Oh my goodness, such a great. So I lived and died for basketball. Like I wanted to be a basketball, professional basketball player more than anything in the entire world. I used to practice until my hands bled, literally. Like I was a little psycho, right? So I wanted to be a professional basketball player more than anything else. My senior year, I got pneumonia and I couldn't play really at all. Okay. So any opportunities I had to go play Division I just went out the window. And it was the most devastating experience I'd had up to that point in my life. And so at that time, I, of course, blamed myself fully. So it was a bad event. I saw it as a bad event, first of all. And then I saw it as something that was pervasive and persistent, and I personalized it, right? So meaning that I thought was going to exist, that whatever it was that caused this bad thing to happen was due to me. That's the personalization part. It was going to persist through time, and it was going to be pervasive through all other areas of my life. Right? So that's one good example. Now, once I sort of had this kind of spiritual awakening and things began to shift and I began to like take a greater hold on my life, I look back now, for instance, and I think, oh my goodness, like not only do I not personalize it, I don't think what led to it was something that I was directly responsible for. It wasn't something that was persistent or pervasive in terms of something that transcended, you know, that basically went through time and space. And all that to be said is that I reframed the entire experience as one of the greatest blessings that's ever happened to me in my entire life, because it's led me to doing work that for me is so much more fulfilling, so much more meaningful, so much more exciting. I get to touch more people in greater ways. And that's the kind of reframe that happened. It didn't happen all at once, but I now clearly see why all of these philosophers and, you know, spiritual teachers and psychologists and scientists, why they all say that it's all about the meaning, that that nothing has meaning in and of itself. We attribute meaning to everything. And that's why nature, for instance, perfectly blissful. Like all of nature is perfectly blissful except for humankind. And you think about that. And that's just because of the meaning making that we do. We tell ourselves stories about things. And mostly they're negative stories. And they're often redundant stories that repeat over and over and over again. So it is all about reframing experiences and circumstances and conditions in ways that is increasingly happy and healthy and productive and profitable. That's the whole challenge and opportunity of life.
So powerful, man. Yeah. I just got to take a breath after that. That's it right there.
Dude, that's it.
You know, Joseph Campbell says, we must give up the life we thought we were supposed to live to get the life and live the life that we're actually supposed to live. I know I butchered that a little bit, but you could look it up. But you had to give up that life. You had this life that you wanted to live, and being a basketball star, playing basketball professionally, playing basketball in school, whatever the version of it was, and you couldn't do that for these circumstances. And you had so much weight, so much meaning on it, but out of that led so many things, and you're living the life that you are meant to live now.
Absolutely. I mean, you can't possibly fathom or plan or plot or script the ways in which life is endlessly and infinitely internally beautiful. I mean, I look back now and I'm like, thank God I wasn't, you know, responsible for scripting and plotting and planning my life, because I would have made a mess of it. But when I've done that, when I've been open and completely willing to sort of surrender whatever it is that has been my plan, even my desires and my fears, to life, the universe, God, whatever you want to call it, but whatever it is that keeps the earth rotating its axis, revolving around the sun shining, your heart beating, your lungs breathing, your brain orchestrating it all, whatever that is, call it life. When I've surrendered my plan and my will and my thoughts to that, I've always been outdone, you know, in ways that I could not possibly ever fathom.
It's even better than you could have ever imagined.
Ever. I mean, ever. I look back now and I mean, look, it led me to do things that deep down inside I kind of always wanted to do, which was like, you know, I wanted to move to Miami. You know, in the back of my head, I was like, oh, it'd be so cool to move to Miami. It'd be so cool to, like, you know, be like a model and to be an actor. And I thought I was the ugliest person on the planet. And I had no, you know, none of these things were things that resonated with me in terms of actual gifts or skills or talents that I had. But I wanted all these things. And I'm on the set and I meet Vanessa Williams. And then Vanessa Williams ends up being such a great person in my life, such a, you know, important person in my life. And she writes the foreword to the book. And then later I ask her, you know, what's been your secret? And she says, I've just learned to surrender. Every time I'm presented with an opportunity in my life or a challenge, I realize I have to surrender more deeply. And I've never gotten to the bottom of this surrender thing. But things then always unfold in ways that are much more magical and miraculous than anything I could have imagined. Mm. And when I heard that, I was like, oh my gosh, that's my life.
In a new earth, Eckhart Tolle says there's three true states of being. There is joy, which is used back and forth with happiness, right? Like a sense of joy for the world. There is enthusiasm, where you're outwardly like really looking forward to, you know, like looking forward to something in the moment itself, right? Not psychologically in time, but in the moment itself. This is the last one is acceptance. And acceptance is surrender. Because part of the world of positive psychology is that bad things are going to happen. Challenging things are going to happen. I put bad in quotation marks. Challenging things are going to happen. Life is not always easy. You're going to lose a loved one. Businesses are going to fail. Things are not going to work out the way that you want them to work out. But when we realize we're in that situation and that we accept it doesn't mean, okay, great, I failed, I'm just going to throw my hands in the air. It means something else. What does that mean to you?
Man, it's so powerful. I used to have such a problem with the word surrender. And the fact that I'm having a conversation with it now is kind of mind-blowing, because it always felt like defeat, like admitting defeat. I'm like, no, I'm not going to be defeated by anything. You know, I'm going to go in harder. I'm going to do. And then I realized the ways in which I was swimming upstream in my life. I was always fighting the current of my life. And so I've definitely come to sort of appreciate and understand a number of things. One is that it's all about swimming with the current of life and cooperating with life and co-creating with life. You know, life is infinitely greater and more powerful than all of us, and yet we're one with that, right? But, you know, generally speaking, you know, it's like Byron Katie says, when you argue with reality, you always lose, but only 100% of the time, right? And I just love that, and that's the truth. And that's not something to be depressed about. That's something to be excited and inspired by, because it means the entire life force and life energy is behind you. It's supporting you in accomplishing and creating, achieving everything and anything you want to achieve, accomplish, and acquire in your life, period. That being said, you just don't want to outsource this peace and this love and this joy thing to anything or anybody in the world, right? So the second that you think or feel that your happiness is dependent or contingent upon anybody or anything else is the second that you're now swimming upstream again, you know? And so there's a question of, how do I get in alignment with that life force and that life energy that keeps the essentially the earth hanging on nothing? Like, how do I get in alignment with that? And for me, I've discovered that it's through acceptance and surrender. And often it feels like enthusiasm. You usually start with the acceptance and surrender part, but then you move into enthusiasm and joy. But ultimately, it's not something that you can source from outside of you. And every time you find yourself doing that, thinking that you need this person or this thing in order to be sort of tapped in, tuned in, turned on, in order to be joyful or feel enthusiastic or to feel alive, you've fallen into the trap again. You know, it's the most seductive trap in the world, is believing that whatever it is that you want to feel or be is up to somebody or something else.
So powerful. And for anybody who's going through a tough time in their life right now, there may be areas of your life that you significantly want to improve your conditions. Yeah. You might have just been fired or had a divorce or lost a loved one, or something that's going on in your life, and there may be conditions that you want to improve, that you want to set up in your life, but you can step into that acceptance now, yeah, and you're much more likely to be able to improve those conditions and also not be let down that when those conditions improve, that you think that that's when the happiness is going to come in.
Just so wonderfully.
Because adversity actually seems to be part of the reason why some people are happy, is when they lean into adversity.
Absolutely.
Can you talk about that?
That was absolutely my experience. Like, you know, my story is one of adversity, right? I mean, had I not experienced all of the quote unquote bad stuff, the challenging stuff, I wouldn't be sitting here with you right now, like having this incredibly like turn up conversation. Like, that makes me so feel more alive than anything ever. But it came from a place of feeling more dead, essentially, than ever. And so, yes, at some point you lean into the adversity. And part of leaning into the adversity means dropping the negativity and the resistance as you take whatever action you need to take. You know, and that's what I've discovered along the way too, is that, again, and I'll say it a little differently, but happiness isn't really about what you do or accomplish or acquire. It's really more about how you do what you do. So for me, I take lots of actions and you know, in my life, and whether it's working or whether it's having conversations, but I do everything humanly possible to not fall into the trap of believing that my happiness is going to come through that activity or through that person or through that conversation. I want to outsource this thing, right? So I want to find that place of acceptance or enthusiasm or joy on the inside. Mostly for me, that means dropping thought. It means dropping in to that pace of peaceful aliveness inside of me, where there are no thoughts, there are no words. It's this like infinite, eternal, just perfect peace. I drop into that, and most of my attention and awareness is there as I take the action I need to take, as I have the conversation I need to have. But it's there, and in that place, you find such aliveness, and you find such joy and such peace and such bliss. And you sometimes get involved in a relationship or a work activity, and you make the mistake again of attributing your joy to those things. But it's never in those things. It's never in those people. It's always in you. And if you can dial into that first, often that means dropping the negativity, and that often means dropping your thoughts and just sinking into this place of perfect peace. You then take that peace with you everywhere you go. And then suddenly, like miraculously, like magically, things just seem to work out and unfold in increasingly efficient and effective and enjoyable ways. It's not because you're taking the right action always. You're not. but it's that you're being the right thing. It's not about doing the right thing. It's about being the right thing, right? And so that's really where I've discovered, you know, you get the most bang for your buck.
And even with that, there are still circumstances and situations we could set up in our life to increase our likelihood of happiness. One of the ones that you mentioned was the relationships.
Yeah.
And I tell people that relationships have one of the highest average, when it comes to our average daily level of happiness, there's not a lot of things that can contribute to it that much as the relationships that are there. In terms of, we know, like extreme negativity or being with people who are complaining all the time, that's actually contagious.
Yes.
It's actually contagious the same way that the flu is contagious. We have a process in our brain, mirror neurons, and we want to be like the people that are around us. So even if you are naturally a predisposed person towards happiness and optimism and these things that you're talking about, you will always bring yourself to the lowest common denominator around the people around you.
Oh, man. I mean, so good, brother. That's exactly right. And, you know, it's interesting. And it sounds so simple, but it's so profound. And that is, you know, what is a happy relationship? A happy relationship consists of two independently happy individuals. So if you want to have the happiest relationship possible, control the things you can control, which is what you think and feel. And if you could find a way to be happy, even when the other person's not necessarily being happy or feeling happy, you'll have more influence in terms of having and enjoying a happy relationship, even if the other person isn't, right? So one way I hear it said often, which I just love, is that, you know, when you find harmony and happiness within yourself, you find harmony and happiness with everything and everybody else, even when they don't find it with you, right? So what does that mean? That means that for the most part, in terms of me, you know, and Barbara Frankerson actually talks about this very well from a scientific perspective, but I want to see the best in you as consistently as humanly possible. I want to highlight the best in you, your signature strengths, the things that you are gifted with, your talents, but the things I love and enjoy about you the most. I mean, because what is a happy relationship but me enjoying you and you enjoying me? I can't enjoy you and I can't be happy in this relationship if I'm focused on the unhappiest parts or aspects in you. I mean, so it's just a selfish thing in the beginning. You just want to focus on, in a very sort of vigilant way, the things that you love and the things that that make you happiest about that other person. That's one way of not only evoking sort of seducing those qualities out of the person, but it also means that you get to have a happy journey on the way to creating this happy relationship.
So for the person who's listening, who's like, Rob, you do not know my family, my husband, my kids, they, you know, are bringing a lot of negativity in my life. I can't just not be around them. You know, you said it's easy for you. You know, what do I do in those situations?
Yeah. And it's a great question. And it's not always easy, but it is simple. And so you've really got a choice, right? You can either focus on the things that feel good when you focus on them, right? So the idea there is just don't put your hand on the hot stove, right? So the stove could be hot, right? So the wife or the husband, they could be upset or they could be mean or whatever. And so you can either, you know, first and foremost, you can either take your attention and focus off that person, right? And you can continue to, and or you can find things either within them or in the world that make you feel better when you focus on them. And there's really no other way of doing this thing called life, right? You can either, if you want to have a happy experience, you have to focus on happiness, right?
And part of that could be, you're not going to argue with reality. That might be how they are right now. And acceptance is also accepting that the fact that people don't have the ability to be any different than they are right now. And then stepping into, hey, I'm setting a boundary here. You can't talk to me this way.
Absolutely.
This is not cool. I'm not upset with you. I mean, if you are upset, then you can say that too. But I'm just letting you know this doesn't work for me.
Absolutely. I just love that. You're absolutely right. I mean, at the end of the day, you know, when I talk to my private practice, talk to, you know, athletes, entertainers, and sort of executives, kind of the three populations. And with executives especially, you know, we talk a lot about executive presence. Executive presence is the ability to maintain your peace and equanimity even in the face of the most difficult and stressful and challenging people. And that's one of the greatest gifts you could possibly learn on the planet, not only in terms of business, but in terms of your personal life, right? And so, yes, not always easy, definitely very simple, right? And it just takes practice. And with practice, you become more cognitively agile and you become more emotionally regulated. And so much of this entire conversation is really about that, cognitive agility, emotional regulation, the ability to self-soothe. So basically, the ability to feel good, even in the face of things that don't necessarily feel good. Lots of times, that's just about acceptance. But at the end of the day, you're absolutely right. You can disagree with people without being disagreeable. You can disagree with people without consistently being triggered all the time. And I know, because I was that person that was always triggered all the time with everybody, no matter what they said, you know? And so, but it is a question of practice, and it is a question of learning to reframe experiences within yourself and with the world and with other people in ways that are increasingly productive and constructive and happy.
I feel like one practical way, I recently started doing these bonus episodes for the podcast on Tuesdays, and I just did one on self-sabotage, two kind of ideas on self-sabotage, how to catch it early.
Yes.
And one of the first things that I talked about inside of there was catching yourself when you said yes when you really meant no.
Oh, so good.
Because so much of our unhappiness that's directed towards others, and we make them the cause of it, was when we were complicit in the behavior. And we said yes when we really meant no.
Oh, I just love that. I mean, and to a large extent, what is that about? People pleasing, right? I mean, for me, it's been about people pleasing. You know, I want this person to like me. You know, I don't want to upset this person. And I get that. We've all experienced that. And it's interesting, 7.5 billion people on the planet, you can please every one of them. And if you're not pleased, still sucks, right? Your life sucks. I mean, you're unhappy. You can please yourself, not please the other 7.5 billion. And you will be happy. And the interesting thing is that if you can find a way to do that, now I know it's a bit of a skill and it's a bit of an art, but if you can learn to do that, what you discover is that the happier you get, the more infectious you are in terms of the happiness. So it's like a rain cloud. It's like becoming a rain cloud, filling yourself up with so much rain, with so much peace and love and joy, becoming so happy yourself that you can't help but to shower all of that rain, all that peace, love, and joy on the entire planet, on everybody and everything on the entire planet, indiscriminately, unconditionally, without any expectation of reciprocity. That is love. You do it just simply to unburden yourself and to relieve yourself, period. So true love, in my perspective, from my experience, and I think science backs this up, is that it's a person who's just flooded, who's just drowning, who's just saturated with and in happiness. And then they're sharing that happiness, and the sharing of that happiness is what we call love. That's true love. That's me giving to you because I have so much to give, not wanting a single thing back, not having a single string attached, right? And so ultimately, at the end of the day, you know, I think we kind of take a path with love that's a little dyslexic. You know, it's like we look for love so we can find the happiness in it. But if we're happy first, and instead of putting the cart before the horse, put the happiness first, we'll find love, we'll be love. And there's a very big difference between sort of finding love and being love.
Mm. A huge part of protecting our happiness, because other things can sometimes have influence, everybody knows, even if we try our best, is also regulating what information we let in. And in this day and age of, you know, it's not just social media. Well, before social media was like the television news, if it bleeds, it leads. Yeah. You know, Reverend Michael Beckwith says the news is really just a collection of the lowest common denominator of society. Oh. If you want to see the worst thing that happened today that we can all relate to in some sort of way, turn on the news and you're going to see that. There's times where I am in situations and places where the news might just be playing, or I have to listen to it for a period of time. I don't watch television news, but I still do listen to NPR every so often. Yeah. And I prefer long format, like in-depth, you know, really kind of slow news, the way they talk about slow cooking, like slow news. But every so often I listen to sort of the latest happenings of the day. And sometimes I find myself, if it's playing in the background, where I'm like, I have to do a gut check. I'm like, I kind of don't feel good right now.
I love you.
Have you noticed that yourself? And what can you share with our listeners about information that's out there, how it affects our happiness, and what we could do to protect our happiness?
Oh, so powerful and poignant, man. Like, one of the first decisions I made when I decided to really commit to this happiness thing was getting rid of my TV. You know, I didn't have to go that far, but I did. Okay. I was suicidal. So I got rid of my TV because I noticed that, and I heard that and I understood that in order to become happier, I needed to be more sensitive to how I felt. Before that, I was not prioritizing how I felt. I was prioritizing, you know, what I should be doing, what I shouldn't be doing, but I was prioritizing other things other than how I felt. And at the very least, I knew I wanted to feel good. So I noticed when I watched the news and most TV, I felt sometimes entertained for a little while, but I mostly felt really unhappy and very disappointed and very sad and apathetic and sort of disgusted with my own life, you know, after the program. And so I said, I've got to get rid of TV altogether. And since that day, there would be a show now and then that I'll watch. But for the most part, I don't really watch TV. Like, because I was just being inundated with nothing but stress and anxiety and worry and status anxiety. It was just too much. So I got rid of it. And I've been very selective since then about everything and anything that I talk about, that I listen to, that I consume, you know, just from an informational perspective, from a media perspective, because it can really sort of get in there, and then it begins to dictate your day. And you don't even realize the ways in which all of a sudden you're sent off in a direction, in a negative direction or a happy direction, simply because of something you listen to 30 seconds or a minute or an hour long show. You know, all of a sudden you're unhappy all day long. You're like, what's going on with me? But you were just sent off in that direction from the very beginning.
Because our brains are designed to be empathetic, to feel what's going on. And everybody's different.
Yeah.
There's some people that can't watch something that's like very violent or like an action movie. I can, and I enjoy that every so often. Totally. It doesn't feel like it affects me. But it's like you have to be sensitive to your sensitivities, because our brains are all wired differently. And we will internalize that media as our own experience, or said somebody's experience that we know.
I love that. And you make another great point there, which is that in the beginning, especially when you're trying, really working on sort of creating a happiness practice, you're trying to build your happiness, your peace, your love, or your joy, it's critical that you do these things, that you, like, you're selective about what you watch and listen to and all that. As you get really solid and stable and established in that happiness that is your true nature, it doesn't matter nearly as much, because you have a different lens on the world and a different frame for the world. So now when something comes through that lens or through that frame, you see it totally differently. So now
I can study it.
Yeah, almost. Exactly. Like, now I can watch it and listen to it. I'm like, oh, that's interesting. Like, there are more unhappy people now on the planet than ever. And at the same time, the very same breath, I think, wow, the opportunity to be happy is greater now than it's ever been. Totally. I couldn't do that 20 years ago. 20 years ago, I'd be spiraling out of control. Like, yeah, that's true. And I'm definitely going to kill myself now. Right? So something changes. But in the beginning, it's especially important, until you're establishing that happiness, to be very selective about what you take in.
What are some things for you? It's evolved over time, but what are some of the things that are non-negotiables or core things that go into your life that set the foundation, that you can build happiness on top of?
Love that. So first thing in the morning that I do is meditate. I call it practicing the presence. All it is that I'm really noticing the experience or the feeling of peaceful aliveness inside my own body. Whatever that life force that's in your hands, the life energy that you can feel in your feet, I dial into that and I just feel it. And I spend time with it the way you would spend time with your mom or your brother or sister or with a friend. I just feel that, just for the joy of feeling it. First thing, always, no matter what. Then I often do a more sort of, I do a little reading. So I'm a voracious reader, clearly the way you are. And then I go to the gym. Like, the gym is huge for me. You know, so I go to the gym. I've discovered, you know, they say going to the gym, really exercising for 30 minutes a day is the equivalent to taking a Prozac or an antidepressant. It has that powerful an effect on your psycho-emotional well-being. And I've discovered that's true for me. Like, I'm just not quite the same person if I don't go to the gym. So I'm religious about that, and I try never to miss a day, except for Sundays, which is sort of my cheat day. It's my rest day, really. But I would say that those three things, reading, practicing the presence, which I'll call meditation. Some people might call it prayer. It's the same thing, ultimately. I'm not telling God or the universe or life what to do with my life. I've got a feeling it knows better. So I'm sort of surrendering, and I'm just spending time with that life energy or force that runs and manages my entire life and the entire world. I just spend time with it for the sheer joy of it. And it is just like resting in happiness itself. It's like resting in peace itself.
And for the meditation, was there, it's always great, you know, people have different sorts of approaches or things that they tried. Was there a modality that you arrived at, that you practice, and did you have to play with that a little bit to arrive to what form of meditation you do?
Yes, love that question. So in the beginning, I remember going to a meditation class. It was like 30 beautiful women and me. They all seemed to be expert meditators, and I was freaking out. I thought I was literally suffocating, like having a panic attack. So that didn't work well for me in the beginning. Over time, what I discovered was a couple of things. One, I was setting the bar way too high. At first, it was like an hour, that was too much. Half hour, that was too much. 5 minutes, quite frankly, was way too much. Because even when I would set aside 5 minutes to meditate, I was not meditating for like 4 minutes and 59 seconds. I wasn't really fully committed. I was trying to be committed. So I was practicing not doing quote unquote right, even though it's a term we want to be careful about when it comes to meditation. So I threw all that out the window, and I decided instead to commit to what I call micro meditations. A micro meditation is one breath. We can all do one breath. So one breath, and the entire point and purpose was to enjoy one breath.
So could you take us, for example, could you take our listeners through it right now?
Yeah. So right now, as you're breathing in and out of your nose, see if you can pretend like that's the last breath you'll ever take on the entire planet. It's the last breath you'll ever have in this life. Okay. So I want you to enjoy this one breath that's entering and exiting your nose right now as deeply and as intensely as humanly possible. Like milk it for every little ounce of joy inside. Okay? And the key here, while you're enjoying it, is to let your thoughts go. Just let them go. Just let the thoughts go and enjoy that one breath in and out of your nose. And the key there is just to focus on the experience. The more you focus on experience and joy, enjoying that breath, the less your mind and your discursive thinking is going to get in the way. That's where I started the micro meditation. Okay. You take this micro meditation, you enjoy that micro meditation as frequently as humanly possible all day long, no matter what you're doing or who you're with. Like that was the practice. Because even expert meditators, they often have trouble integrating this meditative approach back into their lives. They're very good at meditating when everything's quiet. But now when they're faced with somebody who's super annoying or something that's super confusing or frustrating, they lose that meditative sort of mindset and attitude. And so the micro meditation circumvents all that and lets you to integrate it into your daily activities. One of the tips that I discovered was, as you're practicing this micro meditation, if you breathe from the stomach, it's even easier to let the thoughts go, and it's even better in terms of enjoying the breath, but also it sort of induces the relaxation response in a much more powerful way, right? Instead of breathing shallow from the chest. When you breathe from the chest and you breathe in a very shallow way, it sort of activates your thinking. You start to think too much. So small kids, animals, for the most part, if they haven't been too domesticated, breathe mostly from the diaphragm, from the stomach. So breathing from the stomach helped. And then, so that's where I started. And I was religious about that. And then suddenly I discovered that like these activities that seemed to be annoying and a nuisance were suddenly alive with joy and with peace. Like Swiffering all of a sudden was not, I was like, this is actually quite enjoyable. Or washing my hands. All of a sudden I was like, wow, while I'm practicing this little micro meditation, the water feels good. The dishes, none of this is painful. How did I think this was so painful? And then I remember that Zen quote, like, doing the dishes is only painful when you're not doing the dishes, when you're distracted.
And so these micro breaths, these micro meditations, they would be things you would do multiple times during the day.
As often as I could remember, no matter what. So if I was driving, I would do it. And sometimes, I believe in habit stacking, right? So in the beginning, it was like every time I walk through the door, I'll practice a micro meditation.
That's a good one. And for those that aren't familiar with habit stacking and like the work, like different books that are out there, like Atomic Habits, and we have the author and researcher BJ Fogg coming on the podcast soon. He just wrote a book called Tiny Habits. Can you explain what habit stacking is?
Yeah. Basically, it's like an if-then statement or a when-then statement. It's like, when I walk through the door, I'm going to do X. And you're being very specific about what X is. So I would say, I set up a couple of these, which was like, every time I get in the car, before I start the engine, I'm going to take a micro breath or a micro meditation practice.
Take something that's already a habit that you do every day without fail. Yes. People don't think of sitting in the car as a habit, but it's a habit.
Oh my gosh, totally.
It's a habit. You're doing something regularly. It's just you don't think about it because it's already baked into your life. It's associated with something that you want to do or have to do, like going to work, and then stacking this micro breath on top of it.
Very well said. That's exactly it. You know, and in LA, stoplights. They're great mindfulness bells. You know, you get to a stoplight and you say, listen, every time I get to a stoplight, I'm going to actually practice a micro meditation. Amazing how much easier the traffic and the people in traffic are to deal with, right?
That's a good one.
Yeah. Over time, I will say this. You want to eventually dial out of using the breath as a focus in micro meditation and instead go deeper into that place of peaceful aliveness, really the energy you feel in your body. Use that as a focus instead, because part of the challenge and opportunity with happiness or joy or peace is that as long as you're identified with the body or the mind, happiness still feels like it's something that's kind of a little bit outside of you. And so the only real root cause of suffering and unhappiness is really identification with your thoughts, with your mind, and with your body. And the breathing exercise, as fantastic as it is still sort of deepening this erroneous belief that you are a mind or that you are a body. So you eventually want to let go of that and dive into a deeper place inside of you that's not as body focused.
Yeah, and for anybody that's hearing that is like, well, okay, how do I get started? You know, I've shared in the past podcasts that, you know, for me, reading The Power of Now, I very much was a seeker my whole life growing up, looking for the answer outside of me, And I was caught up in psychological time, as Eckhart Tolle says it. And as I went deeper down the path, and a friend of mine recommended the book, and I think it was the year 2003 that I read his first book, The Power of Now. And in that time period, I actually got it beyond intellect that I'm not, I think, therefore I am. Who is that? Descartes?
Totally. Yeah.
I believe.
Yeah.
I am.
Yes.
And that my identification with form is the root of where the suffering happens. But after reading that book, people say, okay, quantify it. After you read The Power of Now and you were practicing those things, and it, for me, it was right place, right time. I was going through a lot of suffering in my life, like you. Early crisis, debating whether or not I wanted to be in university, debating whether or not I wanted to go down this path that I felt that society and my parents and other people wanted me to live, or if I wanted to go down another path. I also think, because we talk about this a lot in the podcast, sometimes there are very physical things that are happening in people's bodies. I think I was severely deficient in omega-3 fatty acids. I grew up vegetarian and not the healthy kind.
Yeah.
Doritos, right. Sprite,
that's awesome.
Chips. Yeah. That was my vegetarian diet.
Yeah.
And even though my parents ate healthy, I was eating a severely nutrient deficient vegetarian diet. And I think I was extremely deficient in omega-3 fatty acids, which have been shown to, when at clinical levels, when you do have that, it can create more inflammation of the brain. And they're saying now that that depression, we have to think about it as, besides the psychological component, which we've hit on in here, that there are components where depression can be inflammation of the brain, which goes back to our body and our gut, and all those things are connected. But so when I came across The Power of Now, I genuinely felt like I had like about like 30% less thoughts.
Yes.
After reading it, because I got it that my thoughts, the things that were causing this thing and trying to figure it out, were actually part of the quote unquote problem in the first place.
Oh, I love that. I mean, love that. That was, I had a very similar experience with that. I mean, so powerful, and so much of it didn't, like all great works, you know, every time you return to it, you get more and more out of it, which is always
so
interesting,
true.
Right? And, you know, you're right. I would always think sometimes, even simple things, I'd think, well, you know, at the time I had a girlfriend and she had dogs, and the things that bothered me didn't bother the dog. Like, or the things that bothered me didn't bother my little nieces. Like, and I'm thinking, huh, it's interesting. I've got a story in my head that clearly is causing my suffering. It's not the actual experience or event itself, because my little niece goes through something similar. She doesn't make a problem of it. You know, like all of nature, experience pretty much the same challenges and adversity that we do as human beings. I mean, loss and misfortune and death and illness and accidents and all these things happen. But nature doesn't make a problem of any of it. We make a problem of all of it because we add this suffering on top of whatever the physical pain itself might be, right? And that really is what we're talking about here, is that, you know, you're going to experience sometimes physical pain in your life, but that pain can be lessened to a great extent and the suffering can be eliminated completely as long as you're not identified only or exclusively as a mind or a body. You have a mind, but you're not a mind. You have a body, but you're not your body.
And for you, I mean, that's so simple and it's so profound to really feel that and embrace it. Besides you, just your own experiences in life and living through what you lived through that you shared, was there anything more formal that supported you in coming to that conclusion? Because it's almost like to arrive at that place, even though it's so simple, there's so many layers to get through. But people say, but what about this? But you don't understand me. But this happened. I went through this trauma. This really bad thing happened in my life, which was all true. Was there anything more formal that supported you in peeling back those layers and arriving to that destination?
Yeah, it's a great question. So I've never been big on, like, even though I was an athlete and I went to great schools, like, I've never been big on practices, if that makes sense. Like, I'd practice basketball, and but I've never been big on like formal techniques, which is strange to me. And even as a coach, when I assign like things to my clients, I don't give them too many formal assignments. Part of the reason is that I discovered as an athlete and as a student, I was so task oriented. I would do the task, and I was really great with it, and then I'd go back to my life, and I wouldn't apply any of it. As a basketball player, I'd do all these drills. Most of my life was spent doing drills, ball handling drills and shooting drills and passing drills. And then I'd go in the game and none of it would translate. And I was like, are you kidding me? I've spent all this time. And I realized, Rob, you have to play. You know, every great basketball player knows you do the drills, but you need to spend most of your time, energy, and effort playing against guys or girls that are phenomenally good, that are much better than you. You need to play every single day, like play, like be in the game of life, be in the game of whatever sport it is that you're after. And so for me, it's all about using the life experience and applying maybe the simple thing as much and as consistently as humanly possible in my real life scenario and not sort of carving it out as something separate. That was one of the things I discovered. I'm not saying that works for everyone. Rupert Spira, I don't know if you've heard of him, but he's great. Like I took a lot of the things that he's talked about, as a teacher, a non-duality teacher. And he talks a lot about just simple things. Like for instance, he would say, if you just sit and you close your eyes, if you're really still, it's hard to even know like where certain body parts are. Like it's hard to really know any of it. Like, in all you're really aware of before you're aware of anything is awareness itself. Like in order for me to be aware of you or this coffee table, I am first aware that I'm aware. And that in of itself for me was kind of mind blowing. And when I actually began to practice that, like, oh wait, like it's true. My primary experience is one of awareness itself or consciousness itself. Before I can be aware of consciousness of anything else, I'm aware of awareness. I'm conscious of consciousness. So just little things like that I would practice. I would take one line or one insight, and I would then try to apply it all day long, like for weeks and weeks, just apply that one thought. And I've discovered that to be more effective than almost anything.
And this gentleman, Rupert Spira. Does he have any books?
Yes, he's written maybe 5 or 6 books. He's written Being Aware of, I think it's called Being Aware of Being Aware. He's written The Transparency of Things. They're pretty fantastic. He's an incredibly eloquent speaker and teacher, which is a big thing because most spiritual teachers, it's hard to, not every spiritual teacher, not every person who's enlightened is able to communicate it well, but he does.
Mm. Yeah. Along with him, any other top? Yeah. I mean, you mentioned a lot of different authors here, but is there a couple, give us 3 other books or teachers that have been a big part of your journey and unfolding into the space of seeing how you're the source of happiness.
Yeah, 3. That's like choosing my 3 favorite organs. But I would say, so Rupert Spira, I love, of course, Eckhart Tolle, you already mentioned. So I would also say Ramana Maharshi, Be As You Are, classic book, classic. I would say Papaji, love. I would also say Joel Goldsmith. Mm. Oh, so powerful. He writes from uses Christian language, but he's really a teacher of non-duality. It's all about, realizing, recognizing your true nature, which is perfect peace, love, and joy. And you can experience that best when your mind is still and silent. And not just that, but when you enter that place of perfect peace and presence, your life is prepaid for you in a way that you couldn't prepay for yourself. Suddenly the right people show up, the right opportunities show up, the money shows up, and it's incredible. So he's been great too. The Infinite Way, he was a teacher of The Infinite Way. He wrote dozens of books. So I would say those folks. I'd say so many, but I'll stop there.
We have a lot of parents, teachers, educators that listen to this, people that have influence over others and can introduce them to things and support them in their learning journey. Even that's employers who have young employees or things like that. Think back to, the young Rob who was dealing with these things early on and not really sure about how to talk about them. For the folks that are listening who have somebody in their life, a cousin, a son, a daughter, a student, an employee, whatever it might be, just anybody in their community who thinks that this person might be going through something right now. What would you suggest to them is the best way to be supportive and introduce them to the path of taking a different perspective on happiness?
Oh, I love that. So I think the temptation for most of us is to use our words to teach. And I'd be careful of that. I would use my presence. You know, I would do everything I could to sort of be the change that you want to see in the other person. So you want to be a living, shining example of that which you want the other person. I think that's first and foremost is your presence, right? And I mean that first and foremost, sort of spiritually, psychologically, emotionally, you know, just being deeply present and dialing into that peace within yourself, right? So that's the first thing, is to sort of sit in that space, particularly sit in that space when you're with this, you know, younger person or this person that you want to influence in a positive direction.
Give them your attention.
Yeah, give them your attention and coming from the deepest place of peace that you can possibly find within yourself. That's more important than the words you say. And in fact, if you just did that, that would probably in and of itself begin to change that person. That's been my experience. The people that changed me, that had the most influence, were people that would just sit with me and you just feel like all is well in this person's presence. Like anything can happen right now and I'm good.
And which also means that all these things that are not working out of my life that I feel that are going on right now, that I feel shameful about, that I feel are not doing well, or haven't done as well in school, or I'm not doing well in sports, this person will not change their opinion of me based on what I share with them. I'm not being judged by them, so it's a safe space.
Oh, love, love, love that. That's exactly it. I mean, I remember doing some research and saying, what's the most effective form of therapy in the world? And I basically came up empty-handed and they said, well, it just depends and they're kind of all equally effective in different ways. So then they said, really, it's not about the therapy, it's about the therapist. So then I was like, well, what's it about the therapist? They're like, unconditional regard, the most transformative and healing element in any relationship, including a therapeutic one, is unconditional regard, unconditional love, not feeling or being judged, right? So if you can maintain or hold a space where you're not judging this other person, and you're just down into that place of perfect peace where you know that all is well, that in of itself will help heal more than anything you could possibly say or do. Now, on top of that, you might be inspired to say certain things or do certain things, and that's great. You can follow that intuition, right? But if you don't get that first part right, whatever you say and do is going to be infinitely less effective than it would be otherwise, right?
That's so powerful. You know, the gentleman who originally introduced us, Cal Amir, who we gave a shout out to in the beginning part of the podcast, Cal and I are part of this group that meets every Thursday morning. We call it Man Morning Thursday.
Oh, I love it.
It's a close group of my friends here in Los Angeles on the West Side who were all kind of transplants to the city, as a lot of people are, but more recent transplants who didn't really have a sense of community. And we said, okay, we're all new here. Let's just start doing stuff together and hanging out. And really, this thing that started off as just kind of like a joke of like Man Morning Thursday, where we get together and we go on a walk or a hike. We'll walk by the beach over here in Santa Monica, and we're lucky in LA because it's year round, pretty much good weather. We'll often go to like Will Rogers, and we meet for an hour each week, almost 30 weeks out of the 52 in the year. Usually, it's only during the summer when everybody's out. We don't meet, and all we do is really just listen to each other. And we talk about the things that are going well, but more importantly, we talk about things that we haven't figured out. Sometimes the guys in the group have advice for each other. And sometimes, even if we have advice, we just don't say anything because we know that what the person needs, especially men, they just need somebody to listen and know that it's okay and that somebody's on the receiving end of hearing what they're going through.
That's everything. That is everything. And that has been, you know, so incredibly helpful to me in my life. And that's one of the things I noticed first about you. I mean, it comes through so powerfully in your podcast, but being in person with you, it's incredible how present you are and how genuinely a great listener you are. I mean, you just listen and you listen from a very different space than most people do, right? So clearly you've been practicing that. And so that's been most helpful to me. And you're right. Sometimes we want to jump in there and give advice. But, you know, as the expression goes, the only thing freely given and never taken is unsolicited advice, right? And as much as we want to give advice and as much as we think people want advice, even as a coach, even when people pay me for what I think is advice, they're really just wanting a friend. They're just wanting a friend. They want to be heard. They want to be seen. They want to be felt and understood. So the best thing you do is simply ask questions and then listen.
One of the most powerful things that we could do for all the relationships in our lives, is to remind our friends, family, or loved ones who are often suffering in silence. Nobody wants to be a burden to somebody else. Remind them that, hey, just anytime you need to talk about anything, I'm there to listen. Oh. In fact, there's probably somebody that you're thinking about now that you haven't talked to in a while that needs that reminder. So maybe think about picking up your phone and shooting them a text message and just telling them, hey, I know this is out of the blue, but I just felt called to remind you that I'm always here to listen.
Oh, man, it's so good.
Who listens to you?
Yeah,
who listens to the happiness coach?
Yeah, yeah.
When he's going through whatever he's going through.
Cal, he's great about that. My mom is great about that. My brother, most of my family, really good about that. I can pick up the phone anytime, and then they'll listen.
And you don't have to be the happiness.
Exactly.
Guy
yeah. I go like, yo, today's been hard. Yes.
You can be the real you.
Exactly.
You're not being the real you, but that sense of like you don't have to be on.
Totally. Exactly. My friend Melanie, the woman I co-host the show with, Jeslyn, the morning show. I've been really blessed in that way. What's interesting, though, earlier in my life, when I felt that I needed it so much, I didn't feel like I could find anyone. But again, so perceptual, right? And so, but I would say all these people, and ultimately, I've also come to realize and recognize, that the one person who's always going to be most interested in what I've got going on and is going to be me, you know? So part of the meditation practice in the beginning was just listening to myself without judgment and being for myself what I wanted everybody else to be for me. You know, that is the practice of meditation. And it can be argued that's the practice of prayer too. I'd say to all those folks. The other thing I've discovered, and I love it, I just got to highlight something you said. It's just so poignant, man. And that is, there's a book, Christine Carlson. So Richard Carlson, who wrote Don't Sweat the Small Stuff and then wrote a number of other things since then, and he made his transition, years and years ago. But he and his wife wrote a book called, I think it was 24 Hours to Live, 24 Hours to Love. But the idea essentially in that book was, it was a very tiny book, was if you had 24 hours to live and only 24 hours to live, who would you call? What would you say? And what are you waiting for? Just back to the point you made, because I think it's a brilliant point that, just reaching out and telling people, first of all, that you're there to listen, but also telling people how much you care about them is just gold.
Well, Rob, I want to express my gratitude for you and how much I care about you. Collectively, we've only really had maybe a total of 20 minutes together in person prior to this podcast, but I've heard so many incredible things about you, again, from a mutual friend, Cal Amir. It's the power of introductions,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, I mean, and he's a master at that.
He's a master of introductions, and you never know what's possible when you bring two people together who vibe at the same frequency. And what you made possible on this podcast here is really helping our audience understand how happiness is something that we create from the inside out, and that how we're responsible in a beautiful way. And that's not the burden of it. It's the power of responsibility, because if we are the cause of our happiness, that means that we're also the cure of our happiness too. And when we set that foundation, as you've talked about in this podcast here, our life changes. So I want to acknowledge you and share my gratitude on behalf of our podcast listeners for this incredible podcast. Thank you so much for being here.
Oh, dude, the pleasure has been, genuinely all mine. Like, I've always been a huge fan of your podcast. Of course, got to know you officially through Cal. But the work that you do, and more than that, the person that you are is remarkable, man. And I mean that. Like, just meeting you in person, I feel deeply and truly and irreversibly touched in a way that I've not felt in a long, long time, man. So just thank you so much for the work that you're doing. Thank you for the person that you're being. And thank you for having me on the show. I just feel so deeply grateful. And it's definitely made my day.
Mm, thank you so much, man. I appreciate that acknowledgement. For our audience that wants to follow along with you and check out the show, hit us up with all the ways that they can keep in touch with you and find out more. And the book, which has been out for a while.
Yeah, it's been out for a while. Working on those other books, it takes a little time sometimes to, get all the gears in motion. But so Happiness from the Inside Out, you can find anywhere great books are sold, including Amazon and Barnes & Noble. You can find me at CoachRobMack.com. And you can also find me on all social media platforms at RobMack, M-A-C-K, official.
Amazing. And which one are you most active on?
Instagram. I'm all over Instagram, man. But I'm still not that great with it, but relative to Facebook and Twitter, you know, I'm a hero on there.
If you like this podcast, show Rob some love. Take a screenshot of it. Post it on Instagram. Tag him. Tag him. And one more time, the Instagram handle is?
Yeah, it's Coach. Or it's Rob Mack Official.
The best thing you can do for the world is to invest in your happiness. The second best thing you could do is share Rob's podcast with somebody that you think can make a meaningful difference in their life. Rob Mack, best name ever, by the way.
I used to get teased about that a lot. All the women thought I would made it up, but I'm like, nah, it's really my name. So it was great. Yeah.
Epic name, epic name. Thank you so much for being on the Broken Brain Podcast. Dude, my pleasure. Hi, everyone. I hope you enjoyed the interview. Just a reminder, this podcast is for educational purposes only. This podcast is not, I repeat, it's not a substitute for professional care by a doctor or otherwise qualified medical professional. This podcast is provided on the understanding that it does not constitute medical or other professional advice or services. If you're looking for help in your journey, seek out a qualified medical practitioner. If you're looking for a functional medicine practitioner, you can visit ifm.org and search their Find a Provider database. It's important that you have somebody in your corner that's qualified, that's trained, that's a licensed healthcare practitioner helping you make changes, especially when it comes to your health.